Welcome to IntelliCast, powered by Skip.
Welcome to another episode of Skip IntelliCast, a podcast about strategy, intelligence, and leadership. I'm Cam Mackey with Skip, and today we'll be talking with Chris Mulligan of McKinsey. As a partner in McKinsey's New York office, Chris co-leads the firm's strategy and corporate finance practices Center of Competence for Financial and Capital Market Analysis. He's also the leader of two really cool digital capabilities, MindSpans and MindLens, which are both data and modeling tools used to improve decision confidence. Chris, welcome to IntelliCast.
Thanks, Cam. Pleasure to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you. So you know, there's your brief bio. So for those folks out there, of course, everyone's aware of McKinsey. Maybe just, you know, talk a little bit more about some of the work that you do and how companies actually can use things like MindSpan, MindLens, and others.
Thanks for the ability to give a little bit of an insight into how we think about things. My role at the firm as a partner is to bring actual insights with impact to clients. And the world is changing, right? So the job is getting much, much more interesting. And I'd say there's two kind of profound trends that are driving the ability to drive insights with impact. The first is there's just a lot more data available. There's a whole host of opportunities around that, whole host of problems that comes with that, like big data. Is equally a boon as it is a curse. And we can talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah.
The second thing is there's just a ton more analytics that are available. And we'll talk about some of those, I think, here in a little bit. But analytics, the interesting part to me, at least, and what I see, is that the analytics are moving from being quantitative analytics to analytics that actually can manipulate qualitative sets and terms. And that's really interesting because we all operate mostly in qualitative terms in our day-to-day as opposed to quantitative.
Yeah, that's great. Maybe, you know, for those folks who are not data geeks, talk a little bit more about that concept of, as you say, analytics moving from quantitative ones towards one that can have more kind of qualitative impact.
Yeah, sure. So when you think of quantitative analysis, you often think of kind of Wall Street or maybe engineering or something like that. And that's because there's just a lot of quantitative data, and there has been for decades in those practices that allow you to kind of do analysis to get to good decisions. What's really interesting are some of the machine learning, natural language processing, and even artificial intelligence tools, so ML, NLP, and AI, if you see those terms. And those are really adept or getting better at being adept at manipulating qualitative terms to drive better decision-making. And so like this shift from the kind of quantitative focus of analytics to the qualitative focus of analytics really is kind of, like from what we see, is driving these now new insights.
Yeah, no, and that's great. And I'm going to pick up on something you said a moment prior to that, Chris. The big data is a boon, but also a curse. So you've talked a little bit about the promise and the ability to make decisions smarter and sharper and with greater confidence. What are some of the downsides of this proliferation of data?
Well, it's big, Cam. Right? There's no way around it. Oftentimes it feels a little bit like you're looking for a needle in a haystack, right? And we talk a lot about signal to noise ratio. Also, there's a lot of, call it the data cleaning or data curation that needs to happen before you even get to the starting line of analysis. And the more data you have, often the more challenging those tasks are.
Yep. That's good. Now, one thing that some of our listeners who haven't read, Chris was a co-author on an absolutely dynamite piece. We'll share the link in the show notes called Strategy Analytics Revolution. As you noted in that paper, Chris, some functions, you know, like finance or operations, they've made a decent amount of progress using advanced analytics, you know, NLP, AI, ML, et cetera, to drive efficiencies, but also create value. But as he wrote in the article, the strategy function itself is a laggard here. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the easiest way to ask that, Cam, is that strategy in many places is viewed as more art than science. And maybe it is, but there's definitely some science you can bring to it. And increasingly with tools that allow you to parse qualitative sets of information, you can apply a lot more analytical rigor. And so our purpose in writing the article was just to say, hey, you know, this is some of the interesting stuff that we see happening in application of analytics to strategy. And we're driving some pretty decent insights or incremental insights that are really creating value.
Yeah. Any examples of that, just, you know, broadly speaking, that you've seen where the insights are helping to, you know, increase decision confidence around strategy, you know, helping identify new growth trends? Any examples there?
A ton, actually. So one of the things is kind of reducing bias in creating strategic plans. It's really easy to have that kind of inside in view and not even know it. Because you don't have a good sense of what good looks like in a broader context. And so if you can think about it almost as a strategic benchmarking to say, well, you know, what do you have to believe to get to these certain outcomes that we want to achieve? And how often does it actually happen for other folks? And so you can start thinking about, okay, where do you want to set the dial on organic growth or inorganic growth, or what is your expectation for margin or margin improvement? And that's great, but then being able to benchmark a bit and saying, well, hold on, how many people actually achieve that type of performance can be very, very helpful in terms of an iterative cycle of creating a new strategic plan.
So that's really neat. So you know, put another way, so you're talking about applying, you know, benchmarking as a discipline. So not just trying to reduce, you know, the number of you know, turns in the factory, trying to reduce inventory levels, actually using benchmarking to pressure test the strategic plan and, exactly. You know, some of this. Yeah. So that's, yeah. So and you can do this with some of these, you know, some of the techniques you described in the article then.
Yeah. And then when you kind of double click on that, and a lot of people, when they think strategy, which has a lot of different components to it, they start thinking about growth right away as one of the big ones. And that's a fair thing to do. When you think about growth, trying to assess what are the incremental growth opportunities, the organic growth opportunities, the inorganic growth opportunities, the adjacent growth opportunities. Like, there's a whole host of flavors of growth that you can engage in. And normally when we talk about growth, and maybe frustratingly sometimes, we talk about it in qualitative terms. We rarely talk about growth in quantitative terms, except for the growth that we've actually achieved or we aspire to achieve, just in terms of a flat growth rate of revenue. So talking about what fields do you want to expand into, which areas are contiguous to your current operations, we've been really surprised by how much we can drive the way people talk about their businesses to understand competitive market maps, to understand adjacencies, and to understand potential opportunities for our clients. And so that to us has been a more interesting area than we thought it was going to be, just using simple company descriptions and the way people talk about themselves on their websites and the way they and the way they talk about themselves in their public filings and press releases. You can actually use that as the substrate to derive really interesting perspectives on market structure.
So that's really interesting. And so as you're talking about this, you're really, it sounds like, you know, almost having an ability to pressure test your various strategic choices or strategic options. Now, is that, you know, where are these strategic choices and the hit rate of them tracked? Is that a McKinsey database you have?
Well, yeah. We do a lot of stuff bespoke for clients.
Sure.
Hey, I'm thinking of, you know, kind of, I want to expand into logical contiguous areas that leverage my key strengths. What might those areas look like? And what is the performance of those areas? Really good question to ask. Another thing people might say is, hey, I do want to acquire some capabilities or some operations. Where would be the, you know, kind of best place to do that? I have a sense of a map of where I might go, both upstream, downstream, or, you know, kind of in terms of contiguous products and services. But what, like, where can I really take that? And so developing a map of kind of contiguous areas for expansion and the relative attractiveness of them, again, based on some of that benchmarking, boy, can go a long way to center a dialogue and take it from being much more emotional or artistic to being like really rational, like saying, hey, this looks like a really interesting sector for you to expand into, but boy, it's a long way away from your core business. And there's other places that may be similarly attractive, but much nearer, and so therefore maybe more executable.
Yeah, no, I love that, because you're looking at the potential reward, you know, the market opportunity, and but you're also, as you've talked a moment ago, Chris, you're looking at the risk, and as you know, as we think about, you know, where are these big, you know, small or big strategic decisions made? It's, you know, CEO, CSO, board level, and the more that you can start to understand and maybe even quantify risk, that's priceless. So I got to believe that you've seen clients and others embrace this kind of approach, just because it helps you have a richer dialogue around the risk of you know, the quote unquote wrong choice or the safe choice.
Well, Kevin, it's interesting you frame it as risk. It's more about, for us, like, great teams can do great things, but it's more about what do you have to believe to get to where you want to be, right? Uh-huh. And so you're stacking up a lot of low probability outcomes. Like, even the best team, like, that's a challenge. And if you're stacking up a bunch of high probability outcomes, boy, it gives you a lot more confidence to kind of make that an investment or chart that direction that you want to proceed in. Yeah. And so, I think that's helpful for many of our clients. The other thing that I'd say is helpful about strategy analytics is, again, when you're in the qualitative realm of data, you can do some interesting things about picking up emerging trends.
Yeah.
And so I kind of think of it as a tripwire to understand, you know, kind of new competitors or folks who might have in the past blindsided you. Like, you can really do a broader sense of monitoring for emerging trends that may affect your core business or places you want to expand to in a way you couldn't before. And so there are some of the kind of the automation and scope of analysis that's enabled by AI and machine learning. It allows you to have more awareness and more early warning of some of those things than before. Now, I'll tell you from hard-won experience, setting up the triggers for some of that stuff can be really hard.
Yeah.
But once you set that up, it can be fantastic in terms of making you aware of things that are not just, you know, kind of a couple of months away, but a couple of years away from being on the horizon. So that kind of additional focus or distance to the horizon where new value might be created or new competitors may come from is really like many companies find that to be very, very helpful.
Yeah. And that I think really resonates with a lot of our listeners who are in the competitive strategy and intelligence fields. And you know, one of the things that they're keenly interested in is weak signals, right? And as you said early on, you know, big data being a boon and a curse, that's it is critical to pay attention to those weak signals because they can be market threats and also market opportunities. So,
I tell you, it's not a weak signal; it's an early signal.
Okay. Okay. Good nuance.
And the semantics matter a little bit because we find ourselves tracking things through the way faculty talk about where their research is focused. Mm-hmm. Or then a little further kind of down that early view where patents are getting filed and what patents cite other patents in terms of getting a sense of kind of the importance and kind of how they're networked together and who and where is doing that stuff and what type of publications happen and what gets picked up in social media and what VCs are investing in, what they say they're investing in. Like there's lots of places you can pick up these early signals and once you start seeing some of them, see whether you see the next step in that chain emerge, which gives you a little bit more awareness that it might be an important trend that's developing.
Yeah. So you know, this kind of begs a broader question, Chris. So you know, I think everyone would agree that, you know, the days of having strategic planning be a calendar driven once a year process that results in a big binder. I mean, I think folks get that ain't the way you do it anymore. But you know, what impact do these tools have on strategy development, you know, sensing, you know, et cetera, because it sounds like it really needs to be a continuous process with, you know, continuous benchmarks you're looking against.
Well, you know, Cam, I'm going to take it in a slightly different direction and make it even, you know, kind of the task even more complex, or give a vision of a more complex task. Not only do the timeframes for planning change, and it gets to be more of a kind of near real time process that has to be responsive to things that are happening in the competitive landscape. But it also is going from a view of a single view of the future, mm-hmm. For many of our clients, to much more of a multiple scenario analysis. And really the last 18 months has driven that home in terms of a lot of our clients. No one would have predicted some of the kind of raw inputs to most people's models that have occurred over the past 18 months if you were sitting back in 2019. Like you just wouldn't, for a bunch of good reasons. So the models have come, have changed between that kind of, as you put it, you know, kind of quaintly, one big binder with what we expect the next year to be, mm-hmm. To kind of a set of models that in which you put your best inputs and what you have to believe and the sensitivity around those things to say, hey, where's the envelope that we get to that makes sense in terms of how we want to talk to our investors and stakeholders and what we want to agree that we're going to do this year. And if those things change, let's change those and resort the model to say whether, you know, kind of how high is the hill that we're climbing, and should we perhaps change and pivot direction here based on what we're seeing. So much more understanding that the future is not static. The future is actually better viewed as a complex set of scenarios which drive from a couple of key fundamental assumptions. And so the only thing I'd say is, you know, that sounds really complex. Now you're kind of up in the complexity, you know, kind of rating both in terms of time frame and in terms of scenarios. Mm-hmm. The one thing that does make it a little better is as we do our work, we've come to understand or we believe that there's really not that many levers or big assumptions that you need to make that really drive the outcomes. You need to make some assumptions about what you're going to do for your inorganic growth or you know, kind of M&A. You need to make some assumptions about where you're going to reallocate capital among, you know, kind of the different investment opportunities you have within the firm. You need to understand where you're going to make some big investments. You need to have an understanding about how you're going to drive productivity and your competitive differentiation. Those things resolve down to like not thousands of choices, not hundreds of choices. But a couple of dozen choices. And so in this new kind of more complex, you know, kind of strategy instantiation world, you know, like at least I feel pared down the branches of the tree to a manageable amount that allow us to then give decent advice about what do you actually do? Because, you know, strategy is really nice to say, well, what might happen? But this has to come down to the conversation about, okay, what can you actually do to get to the outcomes you want?
Exactly. Yeah. And I like that because I think it's easy to get overwhelmed with the thousands or millions of various, you know, combinations of choices you could make. And I think it's a great point to remember there are only so many, you know, levers. And as you start to think about this from the perspective of probability, right, you need to focus and make your choices and investment decisions on the highest probability, you know, outcomes. So, you know, here in the, you know, strategy and intelligence world, we have these tried and true frameworks. And you mentioned scenarios and, you know, CI folks are actively involved in things like scenario planning, war gaming, you know, using Porter's Five Forces. What are your thoughts on techniques and models like those in this highly dynamic, complex world? Are they still relevant or are they relics of the past?
Well, I think they're all relevant, and I think there's a lot of truth to them, and there's a lot of usability in them. It's just now that we have kind of an incremental layer of tools that you can do to take it a couple levels deeper, right? So, you know, Porter's Five Forces makes all the sense in the world, but you can now go a lot deeper and actually have a fact-based discussion about a lot of the branches on those trees than you could before. Before you're saying, well, you know, we feel that maybe, you know, we're going to have more competition. Now you can actually say, hey, we're seeing a bunch of trends out there that look like there's going to be a bunch of patents filed, which may make our position, more competitive. So you can just bring more facts to the framework. And I think that's helpful. But the framework still holds. It's just that now you can have a more fact-based conversation around it.
Yeah, which is great. And I want to take it back to a point you made a few moments ago about this notion of bias in decision making. And man, I tell you, I haven't seen it at companies. Sometimes it's the most senior person in the room that doesn't want to let go of that one brand who, you know, that really should be sunsetted, or, you know, that they think that, you know, this is the right price for the acquisition. So, you know, I really, we've all seen in our careers examples of bias in decision making lead to some pretty bad results. Obviously, Chris, this isn't as simple as, you know, walking into a boardroom with a lot of entrenched perspectives. You show them, you know, the data or the analysis, and they're magically, you know, converted to new ways of thinking. Any thoughts on how executive teams can make that transition towards more data-informed decisions rather than kind of traditional gut feeling and bias?
Well, I think part of it is driving awareness that you actually have some facts that you could talk about.
Yeah.
And, you know, we at McKinsey need to take our own medicine sometimes too. We suffer the same biases as any firm, where sometimes we let our passions drive decisions as opposed to the facts on the ground. So, was doing some stuff earlier today, and we were trying to make a decision, and nobody really brought facts to it. And so I think it's fair to have that as part of the discipline of decision making, which is say, hey, like, are there any facts here that we could utilize? And sometimes the answer is no, in which case, you know, that's why certain managers and leaders are better than others. They have a good gut. But in many cases where there weren't facts before, there are. And so what we try in this article to tease out is, there are a lot more facts now than you might think there are. And some of those facts are based on qualitative, not quantitative information, but that it can help you get to a better outcome.
Yeah. And I think for those who haven't read the article, definitely recommend that you do. But you know, one of the really excellent points that you make, at least implicitly, is that, you know, not every problem is a data problem, and that you know, that there, of course, still is a role for intuition and human judgment, but it's, as you just articulated a moment ago, it's you know, before we make a decision, let's see what facts and data points we can obtain, because chances are there is something that can help shape our thinking.
Exactly, and our clients especially have found around helping folks understand what good looks like.
That's
been a big deal. Helping people understand the attractiveness of future growth opportunities on a relative basis has been really good. Watching early trends has been good. And then being able to go from a kind of call it more static strategic planning process to a more of a scenario one. Like, all those things have helped a bunch. It is really helpful, especially when you tie it all the way back around, saying, okay, what do I have to believe to get to the outcomes that we want to get to? And then you say, well, how often do people actually do that? Boy, that type of closed loop thing is tremendously powerful in terms of getting to a good view of what you want to do with your strategy.
Yeah, I mean, and I got to say, for me, that was one of the eye-opening things, is that as we think about, you know, different strategy and strategic choices for our business, you know, the fact remains that as much as every market's different and every business is different, that you know, let's be honest, and you know better than anyone, Chris, you know, people have been in that chair before, and they've been faced with the, okay, great. Do I go to an adjacency? Do I invest in buying a competitor just to increase my market share? I mean, these are pretty much universal decisions. And so what I think is really powerful about what you're saying is, let's understand what the hit or win rate is for those decisions. And that lets you make the choice for your company with your eyes much more wide open rather than, oh, this sounds good. I mean, that, I got to believe that's really getting great traction.
I'll give you an example, Cam. M&A is a risky thing to do. It just is. We did a bunch of work, and my colleagues did a bunch of work, to see kind of what M&A works and what doesn't. And what we found is over the last 20 years, there's one style of M&A that produces excess returns ahead of all others. And it's what we call programmatic M&A. It's that you do a bunch of it, you do it consistently, you have a process, and it works. Just taking that type of analysis and saying, okay, you can always do M&A, and often it works. But if you want to do it consistently and play the odds in your favor, well, that's the style you choose.
Yeah, that's it. You know, obviously, I won't name names, but in my prior role working with manufacturing companies, we had a few members who were diversified industrials, and they followed that playbook. You know, they. It was very programmatic. They would do lots of little bolt-on acquisitions. Every few years, they'd do something big. But I mean, they got it as a process. They were awesome at integration. And I think kind of, you know, the research you're referencing is the attention grabber, you know, the big, you know, double the company acquisition. Those often fail.
Well, sometimes they work really well, but sometimes they don't. And
yeah.
knowing the odds of that versus other styles of M&A can be helpful when you're being tasked to make those decisions.
Yeah.
I'd also say from working with a bunch of clients on this particular topic, there's something different in terms of it being a proactive process on the part of the organization versus a reactive one. That proactive discipline does tend to bring rewards.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I think it's a good reminder that this whole, you know, concept of intelligence and data feeding strategy, that it can't be episodic, or again, you know, the binder concept that you know, we're even hearing some of our members use the term continuous intelligence, just to underscore the fact that you always got to be at the very least listening. Doesn't mean that you throw out the plan every day, of course, but you need to have those mechanisms for the early warning.
That's exactly
it's important.
Yeah, just stepping back, a bunch of the models that we use here internally, we update, you know, with some frequency. Usually it's less than a year, unless there's something that changes our view. And we actually have most models have, you know, kind of a list of, hey, if one of these things happens, we got to go back and remodel. Yeah. And so just like having that discipline at the outset to understand what your boundary conditions are for the pace of your remodeling is, we found internally, to be helpful.
And so I'm guessing the folks that did the kind of the remodeling work had a very busy 2020, right? Because probably lots of tripwires got triggered.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, we did a ton of scenario analysis, right?
Yeah, sure.
I will share in candor, we really didn't think we'd wind up where we are now, which is a relatively, you know, kind of productive place. We never would have guessed this a year ago.
No. Like,
really, really, this was on, like, when you look at the scenarios, this was definitely one of the tail outcomes.
Yep. But you guys weren't alone. Yeah. You weren't alone in that. Yeah.
And so being able to be responsive with decent frequency allowed us, I think, to take advantage of a bunch of opportunities that came up that we just didn't expect to come up.
And that, I mean, that's a fantastic lesson learned, I think, kind of reflective of our conversation. It's trying to improve the number of times you make the quote unquote right or optimal strategic decision, but it's also just as important as having that listening and the agility that when something changes, that you're able to capitalize on that opportunity.
Yeah, agility is a good word for it.
Yeah. So a couple more questions, Chris, before we let you get back to doing the good work. You mentioned a few minutes ago this notion of strategy kind of being, you know, more art than science, and, you know, functions like innovation, strategy, you know, there's still this baggage around those having, you know, being driven by eureka or lightning bolt moments. So, you know, what are your thoughts on combining some of these more roll up the sleeves human practices like brainstorming sessions, ideation? How can you bring advanced analytics and similar tools along for the party rather than replacing some more traditional human methods towards capabilities like innovation and strategy?
Okay, I'm going to dodge your question a little bit because I don't have the answer. Innovation, it really does still feel like art. Now, you can apply certain processes, which again, different processes work in different cultures that get better outcomes, but there's still a lot of variability around outcome. There just is. And it's something we're looking at for sure to see whether we can kind of get some better clarity around kind of science instead of the art. Yeah. But I don't have a great answer for
that. Yeah. But that, I mean, that's important too. It's the, you know, no tool is one size fits all, right? Whether it's, making decisions by gut, sometimes that's all you have to go on. So that's a tool, but it's also, I think, you know, one of the things you've articulated so well is that there's a much greater opportunity to use, you know, facts and fact-based decisions as a tool. So it's, you know, there's no silver bullet, I think is a good point that you make.
Yeah, well, if you ask my colleagues who focus on innovation, and there are a bunch of them, they would say it's more about running a well-structured process and continuing to run it, right? But that doesn't really answer your question about how can you increase the number of blue sky lightning bolts.
Yeah, sure. That's probably, you know, if you and I could do that, we would be billionaires on the beach in Aruba or something. So last question for you, it's something that I'm keenly interested in, is that as we've talked through this complexity over the last, you know, 30 minutes or so, Chris, you know, you've talked about ways that we can leverage technology plus fantastic human judgment to identify opportunities to help us think through the risks and the hit rate of strategic decisions. Now, you know, all this really, you know, leads us to question, what is competition? You know, we have so many disruptive competitors coming who we never thought would be a competitor. So it's, you know, the world's obviously not completely topsy-turvy, but what's the implications for strategy and insights, folks, that you know, competition is far more dynamic? Where do you see this evolving over the next few years?
There's probably a bunch of ways to answer that question. I'll answer just along one dimension. It's just quicker, Cam, right? Yeah. Like things can come up on you off the horizon a lot quicker than they could a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And so... the agility and the kind of forward looking that we discussed before by having some kind of early trend identification just becomes more important. You know, the process of competition remains the same. I just think the pace of it is markedly different.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder that if you're going to be able to deliver value back to your organization, it's, you know, number one, have the listening and sensing mechanisms. Number two, have those processes in place, as you say, kind of the tripwires on the modeling. And number three, you know, frankly, be ready to be agile.
Well, and the agility really is, it's not only, in terms of strategic planning, it's also in terms of allocating resources in the firm.
Oh, absolutely. So
the firms that appear to do really well, one of the things they do pretty consistently is radical reallocation of capital. And so that's one of the hallmarks of kind of firms that outperform their competitors. But it's hard, as you said before, everybody's got their pet projects, everybody's habituated to kind of what they like. And so it becomes much more challenging to do some of this stuff because it does force you into this constant set of change. However, the facts of it would say your odds of superior performance are better if you do it.
Yep. So I'm going to borrow that phrase, radical reallocation of capital. That's that's a good one, Chris. Excellent. Well, Well, listen, thanks so much for talking with me today. Really, really appreciate it. Again, you know, Chris Mulligan is a partner with McKinsey, and he is an author of the fantastic article, The Strategy Analytics Revolution. Chris, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you being so generous with your time.
Pam, thanks for having me. Have a good day.